The oil price collapse here on KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM on the great big Eiffel Tower transmitter on the West Hills and other frequencies in Cascadia and via the World Wide Web, where you can get a free app for your smartphone, whether Android or iPhone, at KBOO.FM, because we transmit in that manner to all the ships at sea.
Yes, you're listening to KBOO. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Milagro Theater, whose new play, Broken Promises, by Olga Sanchez, addresses teen prostitution in Portland. To find out more, you can visit milagro.org. Well, coming up next, we've got Fight the Empire, and then in about a half hour, it's Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. Then at 10:15 today, Flashpoints with an interview with activist Morningstar of the International Treaty Council on her concerns about Native Indian burial sites and ancient artifacts at the wildlife refuge outside Burns. Also, violence in Haiti in the wake of tainted elections and massive protests, and an update from Michigan on the water poisoning disaster. At 11 today, join us for David Naiman speaking with Keith Lee Morris about his novel Traveler's Rest. And then at 11:40, it's a special Words and Pictures with the directors of the animated feature The Box Trolls, the third feature film from Oregon animation studio Leica Entertainment. That's all coming up right after Fight the Empire with host Per Fogering speaking with Michael Clare about his article, There Will Be Chaos, Big Oil's Collapse, and the Birth of a New World Order. Hey, thanks KBOO members for your support to keep KBOO on the air. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Real Music Festival running through February 8th. Real Music explores the lively interplay between sound and image and music and culture. Friday, January 22nd, Lee Scratch Perry, Visions of Paradise will be showing. Filmed over 15 years, this film has been described as a fairy tale documentary, an almost impossible to believe portrait of the prophet of the International Rastafari movement, one of the icons of the Black Power movement, and arguably the inventor of Jamaican music as we know it. That's January 22nd at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center in the Witzel Auditorium at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information of the films and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fogering, and the show is Fight the Empire. And I'd have a brief announcement here. The Portland Folk Music Society is having their annual Sing Time Frolics, and it'll be March 25th to the 27th. That's actually Easter weekend. And they're having it at the Manuka Center, which is up the gorge near Corbett. And that is the 100-year anniversary of the Irish 1916 Easter Rising. So they'll be kind of having a weekend around that, and they have a special guest artist, Colleen Rainey from Ireland. So if you feel like singing a bunch of Irish songs and rebelling against the Brits, give a contact the Portland Folk Music Organization. It's on the internet, portlandfolkmusic.org, and you can sign up for a weekend up at Manuka. Now on to our guest. Our guest is Michael Clare, who's a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College, author of numerous books. I think the latest is A Race for What's Left, and we're going to be talking about the oil price roller coaster. So Michael Clare, welcome to KBOO.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Per.
Well, Boy, you know, this is a very timely topic because I think it was yesterday they say the price of one brand, West Texas crude, went down below $27 a barrel.
That's right. Lowest it's been in like a decade.
That's amazing. And it's, you know, you think, when was it that at one time the price of oil was about $147 a barrel? Then it went way down. Then it went way back up to 115, and now it's down below 27. So what is going on here?
You know, everything is a product ultimately of supply and demand. And right now there's a lot more supply out there of oil than there is demand for it. Now, because then you have to pick apart why there's so much supply and why there isn't enough demand, and we could spend a while about that. But basically, there's just too much oil being pumped out and not enough people buying, lining up to buy it. And that's why the prices are so low.
Well, the Saudis are pumping furiously. What is their game? They're putting our shale oil producers out of business, and they're also getting back at Russia and Iran. Yeah, what is their purpose? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, well, I think there's a number of things behind what the Saudis are doing. I mean, first of all, the big picture here is that the expected huge increase in demand from China hasn't materialized. So back 5-10 years ago, when all the oil companies were making their investments in shale oil and Canadian tar sands and offshore oil and all of this, it was all predicated on the assumption that China and India and other developing countries were going to be consuming a lot more oil today than they actually are. So they figured oil would be over $100 a barrel, and so it made sense to invest in projects that cost $50 or $60 or $70 a barrel to produce, and they went ahead. So you have a lot of projects coming online, Canadian tar sands, shale oil, deep offshore, producing oil, but the demand from China hasn't materialized. So the price has dropped, and a lot of those projects are now uneconomic. In the past, historically, Saudi Arabia and its fellow members of OPEC have stepped in, and they've curbed their production in order to bring supply and demand into equilibrium, and that's allowed prices to rise again. This time, the Saudis have decided not to do that because they argue the beneficiaries of that would be their competitors, the Canadians, American shale producers, Brazilian offshore, African offshore. It would only benefit the high-cost producers, and they would lose market share. So they decided they're going to pump full steam ahead and allow, hopefully, from their point of view, that the high-cost producers would go bankrupt.
But
it in a nutshell.
They seem to be kind of harming their own interests, too, because, yeah, their oil is cheap to extract, but expenses just running their country because, you know, these 7,000 princes are all grabbing their share, and, you know, they give all kinds of handouts to the ordinary citizens just to keep them from rebelling, and so I think they actually have a big budget deficit this year.
They do. Now, they're gambling that they can hold out longer than everybody else because they have so much money stocked away in their sovereign wealth fund. They had something like $750 billion banked away for this situation, and they figured they could hold out. They could draw on that for a while and still pay off their population, like you said, Pierre. Now, the question is, are they making too big a gamble? Will they run out of their sovereign wealth money too fast, in which case they would face a catastrophic situation where they can't pay off their population anymore, and they could face the possibility of an internal rebellion?
Well, I guess, here in North Dakota, I guess that whole Bakken shale oil thing is kind of going belly up. I mean, you hear about people are leaving. I guess what happens is that, you know, there's a lot of small companies that are drilling for oil, and they got cheap loans. And once they get the loans and start drilling, they might as well keep on pumping as long as the oil is there. But it's beginning to run out because these shale oil wells do not last very long, and they have to, in the meantime, they have to pay back their debts, and so they are going bankrupt.
That's right. They borrowed a lot of money, a lot of cheap money. Now they have to pay back, and the Fed has started raising interest rates, so the cost of borrowing is starting to rise. And so you're going to see a lot of bankruptcies from these smaller companies, and you're going to see some banks starting to face trouble. There are a whole bunch of banks that are overextended with bad loans to the oil companies. Some of these are never going to be paid back. And in that case, we could see some real problems in the banking industry.
Yeah, I'd like to get into that a little bit later, but I guess some of the countries that are being hurt by the Saudi strategy, well, you know, Nigeria and Russia and Venezuela, and, you know, you wonder, I've been trying to figure out what Venezuela was doing. They, you know, when oil was expensive, they had a lot of money, which they... the good thing was they spent it on the poor people to raise their living standards, and they also gave bargain oil to Cuba, Nicaragua, and other countries. But now they're having this horrible inflation, and they are apparently it really bothered me that for a long time they were importing most of their food, which seems kind of doesn't seem right for a kind of a country with the climate and the soil of Venezuela, but they were doing that. Now they are trying to start up food co-ops. They had big land reforms. You know, they gave land to the people. I'm wondering what's going on there. Are they a little too late on that or what?
Oh, yeah. Venezuela has big problems, and I'm afraid I don't see any short-term solution. They had a number of problems. It's called the oil curse, and it's hardly Venezuela. It's true of many of these countries. Venezuela, it's true of Nigeria, of Kazakhstan, of Azerbaijan, of Russia. The oil curse is when oil was making a lot of money, there was no incentive to diversify the economy, to invest in agriculture or manufacturing or anything else, because all you had to do was sign contracts with foreign oil companies to come in and produce oil and collect the revenues from that, the oil rents, they're called.
Mm-hmm.
And Venezuela didn't diversify its economy. It was so hooked on high oil prices that it has nothing to fall back on. And it's compounded in Venezuela's case because the company was once run, that is the state-owned oil company, PDVSA, PDVSA, was run by very professional people who didn't like the socialist government of Hugo Chavez and rebelled against Chavez. And he threw them all out of work and brought in loyalists into the state company. And they have allowed the company to run down. So you have a problem of bad management and now low prices. And I just don't see how Venezuela can easily escape from that trap.
Well, if they gave land to the people, I've been reading about kind of a food sovereignty movement in Venezuela, along with a whole lot of other countries. And... even though there's a change in the government at the top, if these people can hold on to their land and make it work for them, then maybe that is a hope for the future. It seems to be the way to go that if this oil fuel superstructure fails, you know, we're kind of back to basics and sort of back to
well,
food.
You know, they have to diversify their economy,
mm-hmm.
and how you do that is something I'm not equipped to answer. The problem there is that you have a very deep divide. Of course, Venezuela is hardly the only country that's deeply divided.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at our country is no different in that respect. Venezuela, like many countries, is divided. The opposition, which now has a majority in the Congress, wants to overthrow socialism and allow the free market to free reign. And they say that'll open up opportunities, and if the government were more adept, they would have moved in this direction several years ago, and they didn't. So I think the Chavez government successor, Mr. Maduro, is simply not able equipped to make the changes that are necessary.
Mm-hmm.
But he's hardly alone.
That's true.
I mean, you're seeing the same thing happened in Canada. Canada also had an election at the same time. And the conservative, in that case, it was a conservative leader, Stephen Harper, who was thrown out and replaced by a liberal, Justin Trudeau, on the same grounds that Canada had become too highly dependent on oil and gas industry. And because of low prices, Canada's economy has suffered terribly,
mm-hmm.
and there was an election there. So this is going to be true of all of these countries.
Well, now I did hear that in Russia that President Putin has been pushing for diversification of the economy there. You know, part of it has to do with the sanctions from Europe, and they are pushing a kind of their version of food sovereignty, growing there, becoming more self-reliant as far as food and other things go. Do you think that might work out for them?
No. I think that Putin is a facade. The Russian economy is terribly over-dependent on oil and gas exports, and they don't have a very highly diversified economy, and they realize that they have to change, but again, it's like other countries. It's too little, too late, and I think they're going to suffer terribly. So, Mr. Putin, I think, is engaging in military excursions in order to divert the population from the problems that they face. But I don't know how much longer he can do that.
Hmm.
I think he's going to face real unrest before too long.
Well, he seems to be, in a way, he's doing very interesting things. He's having relations with, of course, his ally is Assad in Syria. He's also having relations. He has, I guess, very good relations with Israel. And he's also has diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia, of all countries. And so I don't know what... He seems to have partly broken the logjam in Syria. Now they are convening some sort of a peace conference, and I think what started that going was when Russia gave aid to Assad and kind of kept that side going. That it made the Western allies. Think again about trying to overthrow him, and that maybe the best thing to do is to have some kind of a negotiated settlement in Syria, and partly because of all the refugees that are going to Europe, it's just has created a real mess, and now they're trying to undo it.
Well, I certainly agree that some kind of negotiated outcome is the best possible solution to what's happening in Syria, no question about that. Whether Putin has been a positive factor or not in that case is another story altogether. I think he's been very deceitful about this. He says he's intervened to fight against ISIS, the Islamic State, and he's done nothing of the sort. He's mainly attacked the democratic opposition to Assad, I shouldn't say democratic, but the non ISIS opposition.
Well, the non-ISIS is Al-Qaeda.
What's that?
The non-ISIS opposition is a lot of them are the Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, he hasn't gone after the Al-Qaeda. He's gone after the Free Syrian Army and other elements of the opposition who are Islamic, but they're not the jihadist branch.
Well, then I hear he has relations with them, too, that he's providing some kind of aid to the Syrian opposition. And he's also, apparently, I just read that Victoria Nuland, of all people, is having a little meeting with one of the top advisors to Putin. So you wonder, there's a lot of stuff going on behind the curtains here.
Yeah, a lot going on, and a lot has to do with the UN-sponsored peace talks or ceasefire talks that are supposed to get underway in Switzerland in the next week or so over the composition of the negotiating parties, and the Russians have put up some obstacles to who is going to attend. They're not the only ones. The Saudis are also putting up obstacles to this. But you could hardly find anything about Putin's behavior in Syria to recommend it.
Well, this is Fight the Empire. My guest is Michael Clare, who's a professor of peace studies at Hampshire College and author of many articles. The one we're talking about is the oil price quake. And let's get back to the all these debts that probably will not get paid. What happens then? I mean, if growth all around the world is slowing down, what is that? How do companies and countries and people pay their debts if the economy is grinding down? What happens next?
Yeah, well, we have some experience with this because in 2008 we saw a picture where you had a lot of overextended banks and mortgage companies that weren't able to pay their debts, and we had the financial crisis. So now the question is, are we facing a similar situation today? And I'm not sufficiently, you know, a financial expert to say yes or no, but there's certainly people on Wall Street who say that this is something we have to at least be concerned about. They're saying, you know, in the business pages, they're saying, well, the banks look stronger this time around than last time, but the banks do have a lot of money tied up in these oil and gas companies that were doing the fracking in North Dakota and Texas and Pennsylvania and elsewhere, and some of them are going to default on their loans. And the question is whether the banks can withstand that or not, just how strong they are. And, you know, again, I'm not able to say for sure about that, but there's certainly people who are worried about it.
Mm-hmm.
And bank stocks are falling as a result, and the stock market is falling as a result.
Well, I think it goes beyond oil. Just growth in general. That means that a lot of people, a lot of companies find it harder to pay off their debts. So, you know, you talk about a kind of a default contagion. So how would that look? What would happen?
Okay, now probably there are people smarter than me who could discuss that who have a bigger picture of the economy than I do. The oil falling oil prices has some benefits, like the airline companies haven't lowered their prices for plane tickets, but they're benefiting from cheap fuel, so they're making more money. So the airline companies are certainly benefiting from this. And I guess tourism will see some benefits from it. So the impacts vary across the economy. There'll be some winners and losers in all of this. The question is, how overextended are the banks with bad loans? But you're absolutely right, Per, about the global slowdown. And here the really big question is how bad China is. That is, how just how weak, I should say, how weak is the Chinese economy?
Mm-hmm.
It's looking kind of weak right now.
Well,
it's,
they say they say the last year they had 6.9% growth. That's what they say, which is not good for them. But I mean, it's better than any other country in the world, I think.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good worldwide, but they have a lot of structural problems despite that 6.9% growth. They have a lot of overextended state-owned companies, state-owned enterprises, which have borrowed huge amounts of money for projects that are failing. You know, huge housing construction and factory construction,
for
which there are no orders and no consumers, no buyers. So you have zombie cities and zombie factories. And the question is whether this is a bubble that's going to break and the Chinese economy go down even more. And that has ripple effects.
Mm-hmm.
It's partly why the price of oil is so low. But it's also copper has fallen and iron ore and all the other raw materials that China has paid for in the past few years. So Africa is suffering. Australia is suffering. Australia sells coal and iron ore to China. The Peru and Chile that sell copper, they're suffering. So you could see multiple ripple effects around the world of this slowdown in China.
Well, so the price of oil goes down. There's less supply and less demand. It's sort of diminishing returns on both sides. But even with all these scaled-down economies, they still need some oil. What happens then? I mean, is the price going to hit bottom and start going back up? If the world economy is in such a mess, who will do the importing? Will governments import oil and have some kind of rationing? It just I'm just trying to see down the road a little bit.
Right now we have more oil coming online than there's a demand for it. So as a result of the nuclear accord with Iran, which finally, you know, got the green light on Sunday, this past Sunday, implementation day, Iran is now able to sell its oil on international markets, which it couldn't do for the past 4 or 5 years. So you have another 500,000 or 1 million barrels a day entering the market. And you have all this oil coming from Saudi Arabia, as we've said, for which there are no buyers. So this is going to, until this oil gets soaked up somewhere, the price is not going to rise, and it's probably going to continue to fall. And so unless the economy turns around somewhere, sometime, or so many companies go bankrupt that the supply of oil begins to choke, the oil is going to be plentiful and cheap.
Boy, but it's kind of, well, it's like the oil is too expensive for a lot of countries to drill because their expenses are higher, and it's too cheap. The price of oil is too cheap for a lot of companies, but it's too expensive for a lot of economies. So you got this gap, and I'm just wondering how it's going to all play out.
Well, it's not too expensive. It's too expensive to drill,
right.
Not too expensive to buy, because there's a glut of oil around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, like Canada is producing tar sands,
which is very expensive oil.
Doing that for a while, but that's going to come to a stop. But they could still import all the oil they need far cheaper than they can produce it. So more oil will come from the Middle East than was the case before. That's what will happen.
Well, so
you have to come to a point where so many companies go bankrupt that the supply actually contracts. Then that's when the price will go up again.
Well, that's what I kind of think is going to happen. We're at the end of the show, and we're faced with a big, huge question mark. Thank you, Michael Clear, for being with us.
Always a pleasure.
And I think we'll have to keep our eye on this one. There's no telling exactly where or when it will end.
So, rightio.
Well, thank you again, Michael Clare. And stay tuned for Air Cascadia, which is coming up next.
That's right. We're getting ready to start Air Cascadia here on the Boo, KBOO Portland. In 15 minutes, join us for Flashpoints. Today, an interview with activist Morningstar of the International Treaty Council on her concerns about Native Indian burial sites and ancient artifacts at the Wildlife Refuge outside Burns. Also, violence in Haiti in the wake of tainted elections and massive protests, and an update from Michigan on the water poisoning disaster. At 11, host David Naiman speaks with Keith Lee Morris about his novel, Traveler's Rest. And at 11:40, it's a special Words and Pictures with the directors of the animated feature, The Box Trolls, the third feature film from Oregon animation studio Leica Entertainment. That's all coming up after Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary coming right up. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support to keep KBOO on the air. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate today.
Want to connect KBOO on your smartphone? Now you can with the free KBOO mobile app available for both iPhones and Android devices. With the app, you can listen to KBOO live wherever you are, continuously streaming whether your phone is locked or not. Listen to our latest audio uploads. See when your favorite programs come on with our schedule. Check out our community events calendar. Read our monthly newsletters. Everything is available in one place, including posts from our Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube feeds. You don't need an account to see what's going on at KBOO. Have KBOO at your fingertips anywhere you happen to be with our new mobile app. Look up KBOO in iTunes or Google Play to download the free KBOO mobile app.
Great.